Music from John Michael Talbot. Come home, little children. Denise Davis before that. He is in control from Phillips, Craig, and Dean. We're here at Let the Worshippers Arise. It's 12 and a half minutes after the hour. And we're joined from the neighborhood of Washington, D.C. Is it Columbia, Maryland? I keep forgetting your Maryland town, Doug.
It is Columbia.
Columbia,
yes,
okay. Indeed. And Doug Greenwald joins us. Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times, a ministry based out Maryland way. And you're just home, aren't you? You've been jet-setting around from Kansas to California to Maryland. How you doing?
Well, I'm not so sure I've been jet-setting, but I sure have been away from home for a while. And it's good to be home. I certainly enjoyed the 12 days of teaching out in Kansas, did four separate seminars in, I think, 11 days, and really needed a little bit of R&R, and you could even call it a mini sabbatical. So we were out in California in San Diego, where we lived for 7 years, uh-huh. Came back to D.C. area in the 2000, but try to sneak back there at least once a year to meet old friends, relax a little bit, and ask ourselves again, why did we leave this environment?
Yeah, my wife keeps asking me why we left San Diego. I don't think I'll outlive that one, but, you know, that's life. I keep telling her.
The only answer we came up with was grandparents.
Uh-huh.
You know, we went back to be grandparents.
Now, that makes great good sense, I think. Doug, you're working on a syllabus, a curriculum, on discipling. You had some new ideas come to you on some of those cross-country flights you've been on lately, and I know you're putting together a new series of your monthly newsletters, Rob, of reflections on discipleship. I guess, is it dead? Dead and gone?
Well, you know, a lot of that is definition of terms, but from my vantage point, and I'm simply trying to integrate the vantage points of many people that I talk to and spend time with, if Western discipleship isn't dead, it certainly is on life support. And the question for the house is, you know, if we're going to use these medical terms, is what's the diagnosis? If indeed our Western notions of discipleship are on life support, how did that happen? It reminds me of my days in the medical world when a physician once said to me, 90% of an effective therapy is rooted in a sound diagnosis. And so I'm not sure I've read anything, maybe ever, but certainly for a long, long time, that takes an objective but nevertheless penetrating look at what's happening or not happening in the area of discipleship these days in the Western Evangelical Church, and asking, it says, what have we missed? Where are we off the track? Where did we go wrong? What needs to be fixed? Because unless we start to bring those issues into clear focus, which would be our diagnosis, we'll never figure out what the therapy ought to be. So, yeah, I've been I think tasked with dealing with that question, with all that stuff that came to me at 30,000 feet a couple months ago. And I had the chance to go out and write three more reflections in San Diego in the last 10 days to start to get my arms around this material. I'm personally excited about it. I think it's going to irritate some people. And it certainly challenges some paradigms that we've held dear for quite some time. But everywhere I look, I don't see much going on. And everybody I talk to doesn't seem to be excited about it.
You know, I just pulled up
here. I met to meet a pastor who said, this discipleship thing, man, is it going fantastic.
Yeah.
It is exceeding our expectations. You just never hear that.
Well, you know, speaking of definitions, it may just be we need to define discipleship itself, because I'm not sure that any two people have the same idea or would describe it just the same. We can talk in general terms about becoming like Christ. I guess that's what discipleship is. I noted, though, in your reflection, I didn't get a chance to read it thoroughly, but just a quick scan had some rather disturbing numbers in it about church attendance, and in the evangelical church in particular.
Well, and every time the Barna Research Group out of Atlanta comes up with another survey of Western evangelicalism, it's just even more discouraging. there seems to be no difference whatsoever in terms of the key metric between people who are secular disciples of secularism and people who claim to be disciples of Jesus Christ. Just USA Today a couple of weeks ago came out with a survey that said less than 9% of young people, I think it was under 30, even go to church regularly. And those that actually take it seriously, and this is a quote, are a rare bird. That's quote unquote. You know, that kind of raises the question, what have we been modeling out in Western discipleship that is causing so few young people to want to even have anything to do with it? The data just goes sort of on and on and on and on. You know, if there really were 40 million on fire evangelicals in the United States today, shouldn't that be enough salt in the shaker to have a significant impact on American culture?
Yeah, one would think so.
I would think so too, but you know what Jesus said, when the salt has lost its savor, you know what happens next. So, you know, that's just some anecdotal observations. There are many other observations that could be made, but I think it behooves us to say, maybe something is wrong, and if it is wrong, what is it, and what do we need to do to fix it? And you actually touched on something, I think, pretty significant that I don't think we even think about. Where does this word discipleship even come from? I mean, who invented it? You can't find it in the Bible.
Well, yeah, there's this great commission and making disciples, and so a disciple must be something. You know, we've talked many times here about a study group, a yeshiva, and a rabbi, and his students, and how the students learn about and actually come to emulate and have it as their goal to become just like the rabbi. So taking that model, it must mean being as much like Jesus Christ as we can be, that is, to call ourselves a disciple of Christ. However, how do we learn enough about Jesus to do that? That takes more than I could conceive right now. I mean, can we really hope to be like Jesus? Or it's just the process, I think, that and we call it discipleship. It's the process of striving in that direction that we need to attain, that we need to dedicate ourselves to. And I think maybe the church has lost sight of that. We're more into entertainment, although I think it probably varies a lot from church to church and from denomination to denomination. Tradition is a part of all this. Doing things in community is a part of it all. But the intellectual appeal for a lot of people, evangelicals in particular, is gone. You know, it's like the passion lasts for a couple of years, and then it dies down, and what's left to keep coming?
Well, you know, we discover Jesus in the Scriptures. One of the reasons I like teaching the Bible in context is when you start to see Jesus in context in the pages of the Gospels, you start to see a three-dimensional view of him, not just a one-dimensional, almost manufactured Western notion view of him that we've created. And you touched on the phrase, the Great Commission, and that phrase, make disciples, which is part of the Great Commission. But let me be a rabbi here for just a moment and say, ask you the question, how do you think Western evangelicalism would be different today if for the last 50 years we had banned the use of the word evangelism and discipleship and only used the phrase make disciples, which are the words from Jesus' mouth? You think that would have made a profound difference over the last half century?
I'm thinking if it was the last century and a half, maybe. Because there's something in the West here about numbers, generating numbers. Bigger is better. Therefore, making conversions, filling the pews is what's better. It's better economically for the church. It brings in more fresh faces, more ideas, more possibilities. It's the lifeblood of the church, is new people coming in all the time. But it's different than the purpose of the church, which I think is making disciples. So I think the bad habits have been in place for a longer time than 50 years. And I'm not even sure 50 years is long enough to change that pattern unless something dramatic happens.
Yeah, I was only referenced the last 50 years because on this trip, my wife was reading Ross Duhout's relatively new book, Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. And he traces really a significant decline in evangelicalism over the last 50 years. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. But let's pause here for a moment. Jesus said, go and make disciples. Okay? He did not say, go and create converts. That's observation number one. Second observation is, when Jesus said, go and make disciples, in the Hebrew worldview, make disciples is a seamless notion. It has no midpoint. It has nowhere in it that you can start to pull it apart and separate it. It's only in the creativity of the Western mind that we've come up with the words evangelism and discipleship. And in so doing, we did what even Solomon didn't dare do, cut the baby in half. And so the moment you take a seamless concept, make disciples, and you tear it apart, which was never intended to be, and you call one part evangelism, and you call a second part discipleship. Now with two parts, you can make choices. You can set priorities. You can emphasize one to the demise of the other. And that's truly what's happened to us. I would suggest, all things considered, the easiest thing to do is to save somebody. But the hardest thing to do is to grow them up and mature them over 30 years in this irregular process of bringing them to spiritual maturity, where it's sometimes two steps backwards before it's one step forward. These newborn Christians can really have messy lives. They take a lot of remedial activity. And when we run around in our frenetic culture and we have a finite amount of time and energy and no more, we say, well, let's at least save them. And I think that's how we end up in much of the state that we're in. But we need to be very clear about that. That is a non-biblical way to think.
You know, it seems like the microcosm of this is the model of the family that God has given us. It's husband and wife, a marriage, and bringing up children to maturity under a married couple. And I think to raise that to the next level, to the cosmic level, that's the marriage of Christ with his church and raising disciples within the church. I'm wondering if the disintegration of the family itself, which we've seen in this culture, isn't somehow reflected in that church attendance and that church model you've described.
I think that's a part of it. And in the travels that I'm privileged to be a part of, I always like to read church bulletins wherever I go. They may or may not be churches that I speak in, but I just love to glance at bulletins because I think there's a phenomena happening out there called therapeutic consumerism. I mean, it is true that the family is under great stress. There are lots of issues out there. And so the church, it tries to respond to them as best it can. And so it might have marriage enrichment weekends. It might be raising the difficult teenager seminars. It might have Financial Peace University to help people struggling with budgets and finances. It might be dealing with the strong-willed child. It might be divorce recovery. Whatever these things are, they're focused on a felt need. And if you string enough of them together, I sort of like to call it therapeutic consumerism. We're trying to help people scratch where it itches. And so we have a series of these kinds of offerings. Nothing wrong with them per se, except once again, when we deal with people who have a finite amount of time and energy to devote towards things of the church, those all those remedial self-help kind of things just seem to back out what I'll call authentic Bible study, real Bible study, where we discover who Jesus is, where we discover God as he's revealed through Jesus and elsewhere on the pages of scriptures. And so I think we've really gotten away from job one, and that is knowing God and knowing him through his son, Jesus. And so you find a lot of these therapeutic consumerism programs being offered, but it is harder and harder to find, I'll call it a legitimate Bible study courses, let alone a curriculum, in a church these days.
And here's a question that's come up several times in our conversations. Do they teach this in seminaries? I mean, are pastors prepared to do what you're talking about needs to be done?
I feel like you're laying landmines for me here. But,
well, yeah.
Let's ask a few questions. if 50% of pastors are out of the pastorate 5 years after seminary, what does that suggest?
50%?
50% do not stay with it.
Yeah.
50? Mm. Really? Mm-hmm. The hours are not very good. The pay is crummy.
Maybe the wrong person got let into seminary.
Yeah. Well, it
could be too.
As former and current broadcasters, pay and hours have nothing to do with whether or not you love the job.
I would agree with that. So that raises yet another issue. But, let's just leave that one on the table. And here's the next question. What are pastors being trained to do? Manage a church or shepherd a flock? There's a huge difference.
Are they turning out CEOs from seminaries?
Well, I just wrote another reflection on this whole topic, and the phrase came to me, CFO versus CEO. Now, we know what a CEO is, chief executive officer. I'm running this church. Nothing happens without me, and I'll make all the decisions, or at least approve them all. And, that's sort of one model. But there's the CFO, which, it means chief financial officer in the business world, but I modify it here. It's called the chief facilitating officer. And I reflected back, I had time to do that last week, on a church that my wife and I went to, 30 years ago, maybe. We walked into this church in East Lansing, Michigan, and heard a sermon on spiritual gifts. And it just really caught me by surprise. I'd never heard that subject. Even though I had been a deacon in one church and an elder in another, and I'm almost 40 years old. Well, I asked the people in front of me, have you ever heard this subject before? And I said, oh, yeah, this pastor, Pastor Tom, he preaches this sermon every 6 months. He wants to make sure that there's nobody here who doesn't understand spiritual gifts, their role, their purpose, their vocation, destiny, calling, body life, etc., etc. Well, then to join the church, we had to take a spiritual gift workshop. And at the end of that workshop, based on a suggested profile of potential spiritual gifts that we each had, we were assigned a mentor and we were assigned to a ministry. Everybody in the church knew their spiritual gifts. Everybody was involved in ministry. Everyone had a mentor, and everyone was engaged, excited, and enthused. And so we joined that church and lived in it for 5 years before we relocated to Washington, D.C. And I never saw such an efficient process of making disciples. And yet the phrase was never used. There were never any overt programs or anything like that. And so what I woke up to this past week was the following realization, that making disciples is first and foremost not a program. If it ever becomes a program, you've lost. It's a process. It happens to be a lifelong process. And that process needs a very conducive environment, a climate, if you will, that's oriented towards making disciples. Now, if you freeze that thought, let me ask you some really difficult questions here. Do apple trees have to be told to produce apples?
No. As a matter of course, they make apples.
Does the owner of the apple orchard put banners all throughout the orchard exhorting the trees to make apples this year?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. By the way, do apple trees have to grunt and groan to produce apples?
Well, that may be. I'm not sure. I've never listened.
Point being, making disciples ought to be the most natural thing, supernatural thing, going on in our midst, if it's the right climate. And if we indeed see ourselves as apple trees, and if we recognize the kind of orchard we're actually in. I have never found a church like that in my life, the rest of my travels.
And therefore, the notion of the chief facilitator.
Exactly.
Kind of a servant leader notion.
Tom, who was the finest preacher I've ever run across, got out of his pulpit every 6 weeks and had one of his lay people preach, because he was committed to developing his people at the point of their gifts. And when a pastor sees himself as the chief facilitating officer, helping people identify their gifts, connecting them into ministry, making sure they're aligned with the mentor, and then gets out of the way, amazing things can happen. And so typically under the CEO model, this doesn't really happen that way. And we have the 80-20 rule. Maybe it's the 90-10 rule. We got a small minority of the people running all over the church, working fingers to the bone, getting the things done. And we got 80% of the people sitting in the pew saying, is that all there is? Which, by the way, is an old Peggy Lee blues song, which you might...
Matter of fact, it's in the library.
We have it.
Because it makes a good point. It does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wonder if that would be the theme song for our discussion here every week. But anyway.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I'm thinking about the IBC.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because this sounds like it's the beginnings of moving us in the right direction. The Institute of Bible Context that you're active in now.
Yeah, the Institute for Biblical Context. Mm-hmm. Here's the challenge I've been living with for almost a decade. At Preserving Bible Times, we do these weekend teaching events, which is about 5.5 hours of teaching, Friday night and a Saturday morning. And invariably, at the end of those conferences, people will say, where can I get more? Where has this been? How have we missed this? And I've often thought about, wouldn't it be neat to offer a week-long immersion experience in biblical context as a logical follow-on to a weekend experience, where we could take a whole day on geography and a whole day on biblical culture and a good half a day on biblical literature context and obviously the historical context, which is the Old Testament, and then show them in a workshop format how to weave all this stuff back together so that we can take often our one-dimensional Western understanding of a passage and put it back into a three-dimensional Middle Eastern village understanding, which is the world of the Gospels. And finally, somebody took me up on that, and it's the Community Bible Study Organization out of Colorado Springs, who has 700 classes around the United States, which means they have 700 teaching directors. And they decided that they want to, as best they could, have all 700 of those teaching directors exposed to a week-long immersion experience in biblical context. And so they're the first organization to say, hey, let's take your idea of the Institute for Biblical Context and let's start to run our teaching directors through it. Now, let me just pause and make an observation here. The vast majority of people who respond to Preserving Bible Times and the various kinds of teaching programs, conferences, and seminars we offer to upgrade people's contextual ability to engage the scriptures are all parachurch ministries. It's never a seminary. So it seems like what we've been called to do is to work with the priesthood of all believers, the lay people, if you will, because they're the ones who seem to be going out of the way to say, we need more. I want more. Can you give us more? And they respond to the invitation. They respond to the material. And so I always find it kind of curious that when people get real excited about what we do at Preserving Bible Times, it happens to be from the pew side, from the priesthood of all believers side, not particularly from the seminary perspective. So I'll just leave that observation on the table.
Well, we're excited about this development and want to keep us posted on how this thing takes seed and takes root and grows. And I just hope it's a huge success, because the heaven knows that we need exactly that. And we're looking forward to your visit out here to central Minnesota in about 5-6 weeks. So, and Skype is dropping out on us now, so it's irritating to lose you like that. But I think your audio, let me check your audio. Are you still there with us?
Well, I hope I'm still here.
Okay, well, you're mostly there. I can tell. Hope again after 12 days in San Diego, and from you going to be able to stay put for a while?
I am until we go to Israel on February 20th.
Oh, that's right.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's right.
Israel trip, yeah.
Immersion experience on site, walking the land. There is nothing better.
Well, I'll tell you what, you're in our neck of the woods April 5th and 6th. It'll be like bringing Israel to us. And so you'll be fresh from that trip. You should be full of stories.
Well, or contextual observations and insight. And I just hope I don't end up in a situation which I'm prone to, having 6 gallons worth of material for a 4-gallon weekend.
We'll want to hear all of it. Looking forward to that. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and General Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. They have a website. It's preservingbibletimes.org, which you can link to from our website at brokenroadradio.com. It's highly recommended. Check them out as a great resource for your church and for your Bible studies and your small groups. And Doug, we'll look forward to it. Now, we still get you next week, though, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm still here.
Already before he flies off to Israel. Doug, be blessed. Thanks so much for joining us today. Music from Mary Chapin Carpenter.